Well, good morning and welcome. It is good to see everybody here. I say that especially true this week. Bonnie and I were sick last week, and we're happy to be better. Very thankful to Jim and Rod for filling in for me. It is a blessing to have people that I can call with not a lot of notice. God doesn't give me like 2 weeks notice to say, Jared, you're going to be sick. I don't have a lot of notice to give them, and it's very good that they are prepared to present lessons while I am gone. So we're going to continue a series that we've been doing, and my absence and the upcoming year is going to cause us to have to speed things up a little bit. I don't want it to go into the new year. So next Sunday, Lord willing, we're going to actually do two lessons on this particular subject. We're looking at this idea of increasing our faith, and I have no idea why that's a question mark. Hopefully we are accomplishing that with this series, but our theme for the year is to walk by faith. We recognize that faith is crucial to our salvation and to our pleasing God. Hebrews 11 verse 6, without faith it is impossible to please Him. You cannot please God without faith. And then we observe the disciples in Luke 16. They turned to Jesus and they said, increase our faith. And so we've kind of sidestepped, and we've been looking at just this idea of why believe. And thus far, what we started off with was at the very, very beginning, just, is there even a God? And we looked at several arguments, the argument of design, the argument of origin of life and the origin of the universe, the origin of action, the origin of matter, the argument of species, that dogs come from dogs, people come from people, the argument of laws of nature, that is, that there is observable, repeatable, understandable order to everything around us. And ultimately, the argument of moral laws. And when we do all of that, and this is a very important step, we realize there is a God. Understand that. There is a God. Now we're in a search for which one. We live in a sea of religions. All these different gods all over the place. Establishing that there is a God doesn't tell you which one is God. And so we then need to look at which one is God. And we speculated that there's three things that we could probably find. Perhaps there will be a God who gives direct revelation to every single person, or perhaps a God who will give us internal revelation to each person. That is, just look within yourself and you will know who is God. But of those first two, we kind of dismiss them for a simple reason. If that's the way the God that exists chose to reveal Himself, there would be nearly unanimous agreement as to who that God is. Because everybody would have had the revelation. Everybody would look inside themselves and find the exact same God. But the people that look inside themselves find incredibly different gods. And the people that describe themselves as having God revealed something to them have very different gods. That's not going to work. And so we turn to this third one. And that is, we look for the evidence of a powerful God who can create the laws of morals, who can create the laws of order. And as I observed 2 weeks ago, we eliminated almost every religion right there. Because very few of them are really working under any premise trying to establish why you should believe. If you like it, you believe it. If you don't, you don't. That's how most religions work. However, some do go with this idea of godlike capabilities. There are some religions out there that talk about miracles. And we happen to follow one of them, and we happen to follow one of them that excels at this. That is far superior in number, in nature, and in something else in regards to miracles. So we're going to look at that this morning. We're going to look at, again, the question, increase your faith. Is the God of the Bible God? And our first evidence we're going to look at is this idea of miracles. Last week, I wasn't here, but Jim presented a lesson on the excuses of Moses. When God comes to Moses and says, I want you to lead my people out of Israel. Moses had a problem with that. He had a lot of problems with that. But in Exodus chapter 4, he looked at that and said, why would anybody believe me? I come to Egypt and I go to my people and I say, God spoke to me. And everybody's going to look at him and say, yeah, right. On what basis? I mean, come on. If somebody comes to you today and they say, God spoke to me and said to do this, do you believe them? Do you just accept that? Yeah, right. So it says in Exodus chapter 4, then Moses said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. Now here's the God of the Bible solution to that problem. The Lord said to him, "What is that in your hand?" He said, "A staff." They said, "Throw it on the ground." So he threw it on the ground and it became a serpent, and Moses fled from it. But the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail." So he stretched out his hand and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. The Lord furthermore said to him, "Now put your hand into your bosom." So he put his hand into his bosom, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous like snow. Then he said, "Put your hand into your bosom again." So he put his hand into the bosom again, and when he took it out of his bosom, behold, it was restored like the rest of his flesh. If they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, they may believe the witness of the last sign. But if they will not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground, and the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. See what God just did there? There's this question, well, how are people going to believe that you're really God, that you really spoke to me? And God says, "I will give you power. I will give you miracles, signs that only God could do. And that will be your evidence." Now, perhaps you see the fault with this argument as to which God is God. I assume you do, because most of us have. I didn't see any of those things. Did you? The Bible's filled with miracles, lots and lots and lots of miracles, but how many have you and I witnessed? That, though, is where the Bible once again stands apart. Because, yes, we have not seen, but we are still given reason to believe. And the reason to believe is the witnesses. Witness after witness after witness of these miracles. And by the way, that's perfectly fine for you and me. We accept things based on witnesses and solely witnesses all of the time. I offer to you the probable case that you accept the existence of platypuses based on witnesses. How many of you have actually seen a platypus? Furthermore, how many of you have seen that a platypus is a mammal and lays eggs? Yet we do not doubt this. We haven't seen it, we just accept it. Because we know there's a lot of other people that we trust and they have seen it. You think about anything that you have learned regarding history and you have accepted it based on witnesses. And witnesses that you then haven't even met. Do you believe that George Washington existed? You didn't see him, I didn't see him, nobody you've met him. But we believe in him. Do you believe he crossed the Delaware? There were no pictures, there's no video of this, there's no cameras, there's paintings, but those don't count because anybody can do a painting. There's no evidence for George Washington. We all believe it because there is evidence. It is witnesses, witness after witness after witness after witness of writings and various things. And throughout history, we have accepted those things and we do it all of the time. When you go to court cases frequently in court, all that is presented to the court is the evidence of witnesses. I saw this person there then. I saw this person there do this. I was in a court case. We had two witnesses. That was absolutely all the evidence we had. And it was enough. Because we believed the witnesses and said, this person did it. We accept witnesses all the time. What you are looking at here is not one book. It's a mistake to think of this as one book. This is 66 books. It is written over a period of about 1,500 years. There are probably about 40 different authors. 40 different authors. That's 40 different people that are witnesses just in this one book. Are these witnesses reliable? Well, one thing we're going to look at is the number of witnesses, and that's crucial. If it's just one or two people, we don't feel quite as comfortable. But once you start getting into the hundreds to the thousands of people telling us the same thing, we start to take it into account. Now, we're just looking at 40 people that have written the Bible, but the 40 people then say, but we're not alone. There are a whole bunch of other witnesses that witness these things too. In fact, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4, when Luke says, here's what I'm writing, he says, I'm not the witness of this. I went and talked to all of the witnesses. He found them, they existed, and he says, I went and compiled from the witnesses, and he writes Luke based on that. Was he the witness? No, there were a lot of witnesses. In Acts chapter 10, when Peter goes before Cornelius and he presents this lesson on Jesus, he makes mention of something about this. The miracles of the Bible, the teachings of the Bible, they weren't done in some secret little corner where only a few people saw it. They were done where a lot of people saw it. So look at what it says, verse 36. The word which he sent to the sons of Israel, preaching peace through Jesus Christ, he is Lord of all. You yourselves know the thing which took place throughout all Judea, starting from Galilee, after the baptism which John proclaimed. You know of Jesus of Nazareth, how God anointed him with the Holy Spirit and with power, and how he went about doing good and healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. We are witnesses of all these things. He did both in the land of the Jews and in Jerusalem. They also put him to death by hanging him on a cross. And notice here, you guys have all witnessed this. You know this. There weren't even believers yet, but they already knew it because it had happened everywhere and all these people were talking about it. It wasn't some secret thing. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15, in verses 5 through 11, we had for us this morning at the table, read the 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verses 1 through 5, talks about the great importance of the resurrection of Jesus. Verses 6 and following is just the evidence. You want to know the evidence of Jesus' resurrection, and he says, here are the witnesses. And he goes through, and the one interesting one is when he gets to it says, Jesus appeared to 500 people at one time, most of whom are still alive. When 1 Corinthians 15 was written, you could still test it. You could go over and you could ask people, and they could say, yes, I saw it. It's witnesses. 500 witnesses. And in fact, there's a whole lot more. What if somebody came up to you today and said, World War I did not happen because I didn't see it happen? Anybody here going to go for that? Interesting thing about that. This afternoon, and maybe even this morning, there are some older people we could talk to who knew people who fought in World War I. It was 100 years ago this year that the United States joined into World War I. 100 years. I use that number for a specific reason. It's because for the New Testament documents, the first oldest fragment that we have, two books of the Gospel of John and 1 Corinthians, are dated to about 100 years after the events they describe. Do you understand the significance of that? That means that at the absolute best case scenario, they're saying somebody had to create that and everybody swallowed it whole and then copied it because they're denying the witnesses. They're saying, no, there weren't really witnesses. Somebody just created this and it's a myth that happened 100 years afterwards. That's like somebody coming and saying World War I didn't exist. Or how about this one? How about if I say tomorrow I found a book about World War 1.5 that happened right after World War I, and it involved aliens and Egypt and all these other things, and I have this book evidence. Do you think that people would believe that? Would they then copy it over and over and over and over and over again? Nobody would accept it because it's still too close. The number of witnesses, hundreds of hundreds of thousands and thousands. And then you look at whether the witnesses agree with each other. We're very fortunate to have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We're very fortunate to have 1 Samuel through 2 Kings, as well as 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles. These books tell us multiple accounts of the same events, and we see everything lines up so well. Differences here and there, but the things are the same. Do the witnesses agree with each other? So let's say if we had two witnesses that get on the stand. One witness says, I saw this person do it. The other witness says, this person did not do it. We have a he said, she said situation nobody knows. You get a whole bunch of witnesses and they all point the same direction. Now we believe. That's what we have in the Bible. Are the witnesses self-serving? What's their motivation? Are they doing it to embarrass themselves? Or are they doing it to puff themselves up, to get out of something? I told you that I was in a court case, two witnesses. One of them was a very young child, no motive to lie. The other one was a young woman, and she embarrassed herself incredibly in front of a group of people, and that's why we believed her. Because she didn't say something that was easy. She said something that was really hard, and it made us believe her. You read about this, the prophets and the apostles, and they don't lift themselves up. They lift God up, and they talk about their own faults and their own failings. And then you see how convinced the witnesses are, and the witnesses in the scriptures are so convinced that they are willing to suffer and they are willing to die, and this is not debatable. So if you get these witnesses, this many witnesses on the stand, pretty much everybody's going to believe what they say. So let's talk about this. We have witnesses, and all of these witnesses then start telling us about all these various miracles in the Bible. Now buckle up, we're going to go through every miracle in the Bible. No, I'm going to be very nice to you. We're not going to go through every miracle in the Bible. Let's look at some of the Old Testament miracles. Here's what I want you to pay attention to. How many of these happened in private? How many of these happened to where nations saw, kings saw, people of power and authority saw? Well, let's see, just 15 here real quick. Well, you have the flood, the whole world saw that one. Water turned to blood, whole nation saw that. Darkness and the plagues, and that was one where you still saw, all of Egypt saw it, and then there was no darkness in the area where Israel was at. You have the death of the firstborns, the Red Sea is divided, you have daily manna, all of the nation of Israel saw that. Water from a rock, all of the nation from that one. Did you notice the question though? They were debating, is the Lord among us or not? So what does God do? Miracle. And everybody sees it. The earth swallows Korah, the Korah rebellion. The bronze serpent, and the bronze serpent's going to stay around for a long, 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 long time. But when it first happened, it was, everybody knew, you get bit by a snake, you look at it, you get healed. Jericho, the entire nation sees Jericho and the walls fall. There were multiple resurrections within the scriptures. There was leprosy that was healed. There was an entire army that was blinded and captured. There was a man who, three men who in front of everybody survived an intense fire that killed the people that threw the men in. And this is the greatest of a nation, and the leader of the nation sees this, and the people see this. And then there's Daniel who survives the lion's den. You get the picture? These miracles are not something that it was a few rare things, but a whole bunch of miracles happening in front of a whole bunch of people. And we get to the New Testament, just specifically some of Jesus' miracles, and it's the exact same thing. It's in front of people. Feeding of the 5,000. Well, there you go. 5,000 people see that. Feeding of the 4,000. 4,000 people see that. If it's not the same number of people, you just had 9,000 people that are running around saying, we just saw Jesus perform a miracle of creating something out of nothing. Just, there it is. And then there's the man born blind in John chapter 9. And the interesting thing about this guy is the doubters tried desperately to disprove this miracle by saying this guy wasn't blind. This isn't the right guy. And so they bring in the parents, and the parents say, yes, he was born blind, and yes, that is our son. And they get to a point where, you know what? Because of their witnesses, they didn't see the miracle, but because of their witnesses, they can't deny the miracle. And they have to figure out some other explanation that he performed this miracle some other way. With the resurrection of a widow's son. That's an interesting one. Let's look at that one real quick. Luke chapter 7. Pay attention when you read the scriptures to the additional evidence. Not just the miracles, but the number of people seeing the miracles. Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. Soon afterwards, he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a, catch it, large crowd. Now as he approached the gate of the city, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow, and a sizable crowd from that city was with her. So you have a large crowd running into a sizable crowd. When the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her, and he said to her, "Do not weep." And he came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt, and he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." The dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. Fear gripped them all, and they began to glorify God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us, and God has visited this people." This report concerning him went out all over Judea and in all the surrounding districts. So here we're saying, first century, anybody in this area knew about Jesus, even if they didn't see him. And then you have at least two large crowds that can verify, yeah, Jesus was just walking along, we were having a funeral, he came in, touched the child, and boom, the child was alive. Just like that, you have the resurrection of Lazarus. With that one, again, people start coming from all over the place to see Lazarus. You get the picture? Witness after witness after witness. I want to skip down here to the number 9. Josephus, you won't find that in your Bible. You can't turn to the book of Josephus, and that's good because Josephus wrote a lot. Your Bible would be huge. Josephus is a first century historian. He was a Jew who the Romans forced to come along with them as they conquered Israel. And they forced him to write about all of that. He's a well-respected historian. A lot of what we know about the Roman conquest of that area, whether you are a believer or non-believer of Christianity, is accepted and understood based on what Josephus wrote. Josephus, in his book, one of his books, Antiquities, book 8, chapter 3, verse 3 essentially, writes, "Now there was about this time Jesus a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful works." That's a witness who's not from the Bible, who's not in the Bible. A historian who is respected and understood, and he just told us Jesus did a whole bunch of miracles. I'm not even sure we can call him a man. You want to know what the critics do with this? It's very simple. Two things. First step, they say Josephus didn't actually write that. You want to know how much evidence they have for that? You want to know how many copies of Josephus we have that don't include that quote? Not one. So why do they do that? Because they don't want to accept the witness. They have to discredit him somehow. You know what the other thing they do, and I'm thankful for this, they trap themselves a little bit. They say there's so much time between the first copy of Josephus we have and when it originally was written, that easily a lie could have been put in there and copied from that point. And I say, bless you. Thank you for understanding. You've made my point. They're actually right. Do you know how long it is between our first copy of Josephus and the original? There's no question that it existed because we have quotes in between there. So we have quotes that say Josephus definitely existed that whole time. But 1,000 years. 1,000 years from when it was written to when we have our first actual copy of Josephus. And yeah, there's enough time in there that you could put in something about a man who everybody supposedly saw, but nobody saw because nobody's there to test it anymore. But you just made my point. You can't do that with this one. You can't do that with this book. And their reason for dismissing that witness is the actual reason you must accept these witnesses. Of course, we're not done. Jesus wasn't the end. They have some miracles that happen after Jesus, and they all happen in large crowds. Again, day of Pentecost. You have millions of people in Jerusalem. They all come flocking together, wondering what's going on. You have the lame beggar in Acts chapter 3, and he is healed. And the point about it is everybody's looking at him saying, "Hey, I recognize that guy. I know that guy. I know he is lame. And now I see him dancing and glorifying God." And it says in Acts chapter 4 and verse 16, the doubters, the deniers then say, "We cannot deny this, that a miracle has happened." Peter escapes prison. That's going to be noticeable. Paul escapes prison, also noticeable. And the prisoners were listening to that. You get the picture. Witness after witness after witness trying to tell us we've seen it. Now look at the miracles, the nature of the miracles, and you look at them, and the very basic idea of the miracles is there is a God of gods, and this God is that God. So you go back to Egypt and we look at Aaron's rod. Aaron throws down the rod, it becomes a serpent. The magicians are able to do the same thing until Aaron's serpent eats their serpent and becomes a rod again. Whose God is God? That's the point. And then you have the plagues, and throughout the plagues, the first part of the plagues, water is turned into blood. The magicians can do the same thing, and then they can't do the same thing. And then what they say in Exodus chapter 8, verses 16 through 19, this is the finger of God. This is God. When the people that try to show the other gods are gods can't deny the power of this God, you've got a powerful witness. Why not then consider Acts 8, verses 4 through 13? You have Simon the sorcerer. Everybody looks at him and says, this is the power of God. And then Simon the sorcerer sees the miracles of Philip, and he's converted. What kind of power does it take to convert the man that everybody thinks has the power of God? 1 Kings 18, I mentioned 2 weeks ago. This is this challenge where Elijah comes to the people and he says, you guys have to decide today. Which God is God? Who are you going to follow? And we're going to have a contest. And the whole point of it was, this God's power is real. Theirs is not. This God is real. Theirs is not. Witness after witness after witness of power that is unparalleled. So now, why are there doubters? Not everybody was witnesses. You and I aren't in a unique place. I think it'd be really neat to have seen miracles. I think it would really help my faith to be stronger if I have seen miracles. But we're not unique. Even in these time periods, when Jesus was walking, not everybody saw the miracles. In Judges chapter 6, what we see is God essentially has proven himself. He doesn't need to prove himself anymore. So God comes to Gideon and he says, Gideon, I need you to serve me. And Gideon's saying, where are your miracles that we've heard from our parents? But do you see what God set up? He set up the miracles. He set up the evidence. And then he says, tell the next generation. The proof is here. Tell everybody else. And you have a whole nation saying, we saw these miracles. And though Gideon did not see it, he knows of them. Herod, in Luke chapter 23 and verse 8, he wants to see Jesus. Why? Well, Herod was very glad when he saw Jesus, for he wanted to see him for a long time because he'd been hearing about him and he was hoping to see some sign performed by him. He hadn't seen the miracles. He wanted to see a miracle, but he'd heard about Jesus and he believed in it. So he wants to have his own. But we're not unique. That was happening back then. John chapter 20, verses 26 through 31. This was what was read for us this morning. It's where Thomas says, I'm not going to believe unless I see. And Thomas says, I'm going to put my finger in Jesus' hand and in his side, and then I'll believe. He doesn't actually do that, by the way. Jesus comes, he sees Jesus, and he falls down. He says, my Lord and my God. And Jesus says something then. Do you believe now that you've seen me? Blessed are those who don't see, but do believe. He's talking about us. And then John explains, but he's not saying without evidence, because he goes right into this very famous passage, verses 30 through 31. These things are written so that you will believe. I'm giving you the witnesses, the things I've seen, the things that others have seen, the things that are undeniable, so that you will believe. So why don't some people believe? It's really, really simple. Because they don't want to. When you have this many witnesses passed down for this much time, with this much dedication and devotion, the only reason you don't believe it is because you don't believe it. I understand that there's a real big difference between believing that George Washington crossed the Delaware and believing in the flood and in the death of the firstborn, the plagues, and believing in the resurrection of the dead. I understand that there's a fundamental difference because one's plausible and the other one's not, right? Do you hear what the issue is there? We're approaching the evidence denying there's a God. One's plausible, the other's not. If instead we approach the evidence because we already know there's a God, I'm trying to find him, there isn't a miracle in the Bible that isn't incredibly, insanely plausible. And definitely the type of proof we were looking for so that we could know who is God. And we could find the God who's trying to show us he is God. If you don't accept that possibility that there is a God, the evidence, doesn't matter how many witnesses, doesn't matter what you see, you won't believe it. So the conclusion is pretty simple right here, but there are lots of miracles and lots of witnesses, which gives us lots of reasons to believe in the God of the Bible. Now go back through and look at the other religions that have miracles. You know what they lack? A lot of witnesses. I'll give you one example, Book of Mormon. Book of Mormon has plenty of miracles in it and not a lick of evidence to go along with it. The Book of Mormon describes miracles that happened in America about 2,000 years ago. But they weren't written down by the witnesses of that time who were just so amazed by it that they wrote it down and they copied it and copied it and copied it and passed it down to everybody. No, instead, they just simply disappeared. No writings existed for 2,000 years until Joseph Smith, one guy, happens to say, hey, I can read this thing that I found. Does this sound at all familiar? Somebody saying there's a World War 1.5. That's exactly what he's doing. One person can read it. Three people supposedly have seen it, and that is it. It's no longer here. And that was just for a book describing miracles that supposedly happened in America 2,000 years ago. Versus books written down by the witnesses, handed down, and passed down pretty much without break from the very beginning. Evidence, nothing. And that's what you'll find. And I'm not trying to dissuade you. I encourage you, go look at the other religions to increase your faith in this one. If you look for evidence, you will keep coming back here to this God. We're going to look at a few more things next week on this, and then we'll go to the third phase, and we won't spend a lot of time on that, and that is, how do I serve this God? There's so many different ways of serving God of the Bible. What's the correct way to do that? I appreciate your time and your attention. I hope that this is beneficial to you. It has been for me. It has been increasing my faith as I go back through and I refresh my memory on these things, on why I believe. If you are not a Christian, we encourage you to become one. To dedicate yourself to a God who is real, a God who loves you, and a God who has sent His Son to save you. Won't you die to yourself to live to Him? So that you might have eternal life with Him. If you believe, if you're willing to repent and confess and be baptized into Jesus, won't you come? And if you're a Christian and you have fallen away, we encourage you to come as we stand and as we sing.
Captain along the hills of life, ye Christian soldiers.